for me to introduce my next speaker, Alison Gottman. I met Alison, I think, 6 or 7 years ago now at a causation meeting, and then at several more causation meetings after that. But this is the first time Alison's been to Australia, so it's a great pleasure, Alison, to welcome you here. And Alison's going to be speaking to us on why don't Pavlov's dogs and two-year-olds ring the bell, action, intervention, and correlation in causal reasoning. Welcome.
Great. Well, I want to thank you very much for inviting me here, especially in January when I could be in London. And to organizing this workshop, which has been a great way to meet some of the fellow people working on causation in Australia. What I'm going to talk about today is essentially part one of Peter's project, which is actually trying to understand what our everyday causal conceptions are all about. The typical way that philosophers have done this is by consulting the intuitions of adults, and particularly adult philosophers. But the way that we do this as psychologists is by trying to use other kinds of methods to figure out what it is that people think about causation. And I think a particularly illuminating way of trying to answer that question one is to look at the development of our ideas about causation. So if you look just at the adult intuitions, they're something of what in England they call a dog's breakfast. There's lots and lots of different kinds of things that seem to feature in our adult intuitions about causation. And those different kinds of intuitions we have about what is important for causation or even what causation consists in are reflected in various psychological as well as philosophical theories, very, very different kinds of theories about what causation is all about. So one whole set of theories, in some sense going back to Hume, but in the psychological context, most associated with sort of associationism, is the idea that causation is just correlation. Causation just has to do with associations between events. And interestingly, some of the most fundamental associationist theories in psychology, like the Roscorla-Wagner rule, can be cashed out in terms of thinking about causation as a kind of correlation or association. The whole other set of theories are theories about physical mechanisms, the idea that somehow there's some set of physical events that constitute causation. This goes back to Michaud and psychology, pointing out that certain kinds of sequences, like contact and launching sequences, are perceived as being causal. Ellen Leslie has shown that even infants seem to have some of these intuitions. You can see those as mapping onto various kinds of mechanism theories in philosophy about how causation works. Piaget and others in psychology have suggested that causation has its roots in the relationship between our willed actions, that the relationship between our decision to act and our action is the sort of fundamental causal link. That was actually Piaget's theory. And this ties on to various kinds of action theories about causation in philosophy. And most recently, there's been a whole set of theories that I'll call interventionist theories, which are the theories I'm going to be talking about the most, that come from the general Bayesnet framework for understanding causation that comes from people like Clark Leymore and Judea Pearl, and has been philosophically, I think, most clearly articulated by Jim Woodward. So there's all these different kinds of theories, all these different kinds of intuitions we have about the very fact of what it means for something to be causal at all, let alone all the other things that we could ask, questions we could ask about causal reasoning and causal learning. So one thing that we can do as developmentalists is to ask which bits and pieces of the idea of causation are in place at what point, and how are those bits and pieces integrated or changed or developed. And that might tell us something about which understandings are more fundamental and foundational, and then which other understandings are derived, and in what way they're derived from those more fundamental or foundational understandings. Okay, so let me start out by saying something about the interventionist theory. This is, Jim has actually worked this out in a very careful way. This is just one part, one way of stating the interventionist account. So what the interventionist account says informally is what makes X a direct cause of Y, where X and Y now are variables rather than events, is that if you wiggle X, to use the technical term, if you do something to change the value of X, then the value of Y will also change. And the idea here is that these, and that actually turns out to be a definition that captures a lot of our ordinary intuitions about what causation is all about, although not necessarily our intuitions about actual causation, captures these intuitions we have about type causation, about what kinds of things out in the world are related to what other kinds of things in the world. So a very good example of this is if you think about the relationship between having yellow fingers and getting lung cancer, there's a correlation between having yellow fingers and getting lung cancer. We can predict that we have lung cancer based on having yellow fingers, but we don't think that there's a causal relation, and we could cash that out by saying we don't think that washing people's fingers is going to change the rate of lung cancer, whereas we do think that with when we think that smoking causes lung cancer. So this is a formal definition that actually seems to track our everyday intuitions quite accurately. And this definition is related to counterfactual ideas, but a point that Jim has made and that I think is important psychologically is that if you're trying to figure out why it is, say, from an evolutionary or developmental point of view, that we would have this idea, it's kind of hard to see how facts about counterfactuals could actually, say, influence our evolutionary success or influence our attempts to get along in the world. Whereas facts about interventions, facts about what we can do to bring about various kinds of changes in the world, are obviously extremely relevant to our success, either from an evolutionary point of view or from a pragmatic and practical point of view. Now, this particular formal philosophical account of intervention, in this particular formal or philosophical account of intervention, an intervention is itself an abstract causal notion. So this is a non-reductive account of causation. And in particular, an intervention is a cause, a direct cause, which changes or sets the value of a variable, but is not itself caused by any of the other causes in the system of interest. So it's an exogenous cause. So something like a natural experiment in economics counts as being an intervention. And it's an intervention only in a counterfactual. This claim is itself a counterfactual claim in that it needn't actually be an actual intervention. So you can say that if we moved the moon, then that would change the pattern of tides, even though we don't think that there's anybody who actually can bring about the intervention of moving the moon. So from a philosophical point of view, we have this quite abstract concept of intervention, and this is also the abstract concept of intervention that plays a crucial role in the kinds of structural equations that constitute causation on lots of people's views metaphysically. But from a psychological perspective, you might ask, how is that very abstract? Do we as adults, for example, have this very abstract concept of intervention, and where would this abstract concept of intervention come from? And an obvious thought is that this very abstract concept of intervention is related to something that's extremely important to us, which is our actual goal-directed interventions and actions on the world, the actions that we perform in order to bring about events. That's sort of what we usually think of as being an intervention, is the things that we do on the world to bring about changes in the world. So an interesting hypothesis might be that initially our notion of causation isn't this abstract notion, but it's a notion that's connected to our goal-directed actions on the world. And again, this tracks philosophical ideas that people in this room have argued for and thought about in the past. Jim actually, in a paper in 2007, in a volume that we did about causal learning, looking at the relationships between the psychology and philosophy of causal learning, actually made an interesting suggestion, which is that there are several different stages you might imagine in the development of a concept of intervention, which lead to different kinds of concepts of causation. So the idea is that you might start out by considering an agent or a creature that starts out with a kind of egocentric notion of intervention and therefore an egocentric notion of causation. So what such a creature would in effect think is that when it does something, when it acts to bring about a certain kind of event, there are very characteristic relationships between that action and outcomes, and that those constitute, as it were, for that creature, causal structure. And the suggestion is that if you look at things like operant conditioning in the world of animal learning, you could think about an animal learning by operant conditioning as being this kind of an egocentric causal agent. The animal who learns because the pigeon who learns that if it pecks a lever, then it will get
it'll get food pellets. You could think of that animal as in effect saying there's a causal relationship between the outcomes of my goal-directed actions and those actions themselves. A sort of broader view that you might have, the second view is what Jim calls an agent causal viewpoint. So you might recognize not only that you can intervene on the world to bring about events, but you might also recognize that other people can do the same thing. And when you actually see other people or conspecifics, other animals producing this goal-directed these goal-directed actions and then see the downstream effects of those actions, you might think that those are causal in the same way that the operantly conditioned pigeons might think that their own actions are causal. And then the third stage would be to consider an agent who thinks not only that the outcomes of their own actions are causal and that the outcomes of the actions of other people are causal, but that there are actually causal relationships independently out there in the world that would support those kinds of actions independently of actually, even if no one actually ever does produce the actions. This is the sort of more abstract notion of a causal relationship subject intervention that is in Woodward's philosophical theory. So an interesting question becomes, is this sort of philosophical account of more and more sophisticated causal viewpoints, is that reflected empirically in either an evolutionary way or a developmental way in our understanding of causation? And now I'm going to talk about a bunch of experiments that I and in collaboration with other people have done that suggest that there might actually be a psychological basis for this conceptual or philosophical sequence of ideas about causation. The first set of experiments I'm going to talk about were actually done by Liz Bonowitz, who was a graduate student in MIT, is now a postdoc in my lab, and Laura Schultz, my ex-student who's now at MIT, based on a bunch of theoretical conversations that we had with Jim and with me and with Andy Meltzoff, who I'm going to talk about in a minute. And by the way, this comes out of a project that we've been working on for about 7 years. I think this was probably where Hugh and I, in fact, first met, which is the McDonald Foundation funds a collaborative, which is half developmental psychologists and half philosophers and computationalists, called the Causal Learning Collaborative, that's been a collaborative project designed to just bring together these philosophical and empirical issues. So this is a very good, and Jim Woodward and Chris Hitchcock are part of it, and this is a very good example of the product of that kind of a collaboration. Okay, so how could we actually test this philosophical idea? Well, a way to test it would be to try to see when children, for instance, use predictive relationships to design their own interventions. So when do children, what kinds of data are children willing to treat as causal? And what's the role of intentional agency? And one of the interesting things that Liz and Laura looked at was what's the effect of causal language on modifying or changing our causal conceptions. So here's the basic experimental setup. What happens is that the children see a setup like this, where there's a block, and the block, one block makes an impact with the other block, and then there's a distant outcome, that thing turns around. And what happens is the children actually see several instances of this event, so that there's a correlation between the collision between the two blocks. There's a correlation between the collision between the two blocks and this outcome. So from a correlational perspective, you might say that you've got some evidence that there's a causal link between the two blocks colliding and the causal outcome. So the first question you might ask is, are children actually picking up this correlation? So in order to test that, what Liz and Laura did was to provide the children with one trial, that was the trial that you just saw, where the outcome actually didn't take place, and then see if they looked towards the outcome, right? So when you've seen the correlation, if you actually think there's some causal relationship, and now the outcome doesn't take place, you should be sort of surprised and look to the outcome to try and figure it out. And in fact, all of the children in all of their studies did that. So when there was the catch trial, they looked to try and see what was going to happen to the outcome, which suggests that they had in fact tracked the correlation. Then what they did was have another trial where the correlation actually takes place, and then actually give the child the block and say, can you make the plane spin? And now the question is, what are the children going to do in this circumstance? If you do this task with preschoolers, 3 and 4 year olds, What happens is that the children, as you would expect, pick up the block and move the block and make contact with the other block and make the plane spin. But interestingly, 24-month-olds, the reason why that column looks so low is because none of the 24-month-olds did this. So none of the 24-month-olds ever used the block to actually go and bring about the outcome. Even though in a control condition, if you simply said to them, can you move the block, the children were perfectly capable and happy to move the block. So only the older children seemed to believe that just observation indicated a possible causal relationship. In spite of the fact that they could predict the outcome of the event as evidenced by their looking behavior. Well, what happens if you actually introduce intentional agency? So this is what might be a sign that these children don't yet have the sort of Woodward's full causal concept. Do they have the sort of agent causal concept? So in order to determine if this was true, just a small change to the methodology. Now instead of the block simply moving to make contact with the other block, the only difference is that now there's a hand that's actually moving the block to make contact with the other block. So there's actually a person who's doing it. And if you do that in the same way that you did the previous experiment, otherwise the two experiments are completely identical. So again, on multiple occasions, the hand is making contact with the... Interestingly, on the last occasion, what happens is the child just sees this, just sees the event without the hand. And on that last occasion, you want to see whether the child looks to the outcome to see whether they've actually mastered the correlation. And in this case, if you actually show the child the agent producing the action, then the children immediately pick up the block and move it to make contact with the object. So it looks as if it wasn't just that the children were inhibited or scared or something like that in the first case, because when they actually see that this is the outcome of a human action, then they seem to treat it as if it's causal for their own purposes. Although there could be some objections to that, which I'll get to later on. What about if you actually give the children information about causal language? So you actually use some causal language. It could be that if you actually use causal language, that might help the children to sort of put together information about correlation and information about agency. And you might think of different kinds of ways that you could do this. One way that would make the relationship between between agent causation and correlation very clear would be if you actually used identical language. So you said, the block makes it go, and then you said, can you make it go at the end? But it could be that causal language would even work more indirectly. So perhaps what if you said, oh, the block makes it go as they're seeing the correlation, and then you said, can you turn on the toy? So you're not actually using exactly the same language, but just the very fact of having used causal language might make a difference to the inferences that the children are making. And then in a control, so what they did was to have one case where the language is identical in the demonstration and the test, so the children are seeing exactly what you just saw, except that now every time that the block makes contact, the experimenter says the block makes it go, and then asks, can you make it go? In the second case, each time the experimenter says the block makes it go, and then says, can you turn on the toy? And then in a non-causal language control, the experimenter just says, here it goes, let's watch the show, look at my block, and then says, can you make it go? And here are the results. As I mentioned, if you actually include agency, so you include the hand, then the toddlers, the 24-month-olds, start to look like the 4-year-olds. They're actually doing the right set of interventions. And the same thing turns out to be true if you actually add in causal language. So if you actually say the block makes it go, then even when they don't see the hand, when they just see the correlation, the children seem to treat that as the basis for action. And again, that suggests that their failure in the original experiment isn't because they don't know how to move it or because they're shy or because they don't want to. It really suggests that it's something conceptual and something about causation in particular that's relevant to this failure. So there's some suggestion that causal language, agency, correlation are becoming integrated for the older, that agency and correlation are becoming integrated for the older children, and that language might be playing a role in this. Now, I mentioned at the beginning about ideas about mechanism, these kind of Michaudian physical ideas. You might also ask, well, how do ideas about mechanism, contact, causation fit into this picture? And in order to do this, Liz and Laura used a different dependent measure. This is actually work that they did with Paul Munter. And here's the way this experiment went. So in this experiment, what happened was that there's actually a screen up in front of the blogs, and the children see the same sequences of events that you just saw. But now they don't actually see whether or not there's contact between the two blocks, right? So they see that one block goes behind the screen, and then they see that there's a regular outcome. And in another condition, they see exactly the same thing, but now there's no outcome. So they see the two blocks, but nothing happens as a result of the two blocks being there. And again, now what happens is you remove the screen. And when you remove the screen, the children see one of two things. Either they see contact between the two blocks, okay, in one condition, or they see no contact between the two blocks. So they see the two blocks are separate when you move the screen in the other condition. Now, what we know from lots of experimental methodology is that children look longer at things that are unexpected. So the question is, do the children expect that in the case where there's an outcome, there should also be physical contact, right? So they did two versions of this. In one case, what happens is that they used causal language, said on each case, the block is making the toy go. And in the other case, they simply showed the correlations without the causal language. And the result is that with no causal language, the children didn't seem to have any expectations about contact at all. They didn't seem to think that it was more likely that there was contact between the blocks than not contact between the blocks. But with causal language, the children seemed to think that if there was a particular outcome, right, if the plane spun, then it was more likely that there was actually contact between the blocks. Right. Whereas if there wasn't an outcome, then they actually had the opposite prediction. If there wasn't an outcome, then they predicted that then they made the opposite prediction. So the causal language seemed to be serving as a way of kind of integrating information about correlation and the effect and information about contact and mechanism. So the children were not making predictions about contact just as a result of seeing the correlation, but they did make those predictions if causal language was actually used as well. So what this suggests is that the very young children might be having difficulty having something like the full causal picture that that Jim talks about, and that language might be involved in integrating both correlation and agency and also integrating mechanism information into a single notion of causality, something like Jim's full causal understanding. In fact, sort of an even fuller full causal understanding than Jim's, because it would include this dimension about the folk physics and about mechanisms as well as about agency and correlation. Now, let's go back for a minute. What that shows is the children don't have the full causal picture, but you could still ask, well, do they have just an egotistical picture, or do they have something more like Jim's agent causation? And remember, there was the experiment in which the children actually saw the agent move the block to bring about the outcome. And you might think, well, maybe that shows that they actually have the agent causation theory. But there's a problem with that. And the problem is, it could be, so remember, what the children saw the object make contact, and then they got the object themselves, and then they also made contact with the object. And they also looked towards the outcome. The trouble is, we know that from the time that babies and children are very young, they'll simply imitate actions. So it's conceivable that what the children were doing in that case was not actually performing an intervention to bring about the event. Maybe they were just imitating what the experimenter did and then predicting that that particular event was going to be followed by a particular outcome. So we don't know that they were really, what their response in that case was really an intervention designed to bring about the effect. It might be that it was just an imitation of the action that the other person performed, and maybe an imitation plus a prediction about what would happen as a result of that action. So how could you actually tell if the children were really understanding the agent causation and were really producing a genuine intervention in this case in a way that would show that they actually understood something deeper about causal relationships? Well, as a result of lots of discussion with the philosophers, and thinking with the psychologists, one idea would be that you could get a better measure of whether the children really had a causal understanding and really had interventions by giving them a choice between two different actions that they could perform. So in the experiment that Liz and Laura did, there was really only one action that you could perform. It was a question about did you make the block go or not? And it's sort of striking that the children don't, you might think even if the children didn't understand the causal circumstance, there's such a limited number of things to do that they would have done. And it's sort of striking that they don't do it. The negative part seems very strong there. But we don't know that when they do it, say in the causal language case, they're really doing it in order to bring about the event. So to try to test this, Andy Maltzoff and Anna Weissman and I designed a procedure in which the children actually have a choice between two possible actions. So this is a little more like a kind of counterfactual intervention because there's alternatives that you could choose. And the way that this procedure went is that the child sees these two platforms and there's this egg-shaped thing in the middle, and the experimenter pokes one of the platforms and the egg lights up, and then he pokes the other platform and the egg doesn't light up, and this is all counterbalanced. So now the question is, what will the child choose to do? The child's seen both of the actions, so if the child was simply imitating the actions, they should be just as likely to imitate one or the other. But if they're thinking that the point of the action is actually to make the egg light up, then they should choose the one that's correlated with the egg lighting up rather than the one that isn't. And in fact, the experimenter does this several times so that the children can actually see the correlation. And then we give the infants a chance to intervene. And we did it two different ways. One was with the poking thing. The other trial involved taking a little dog and putting it on one platform rather than the other and having an X in the middle actually light up. And then the test is to simply give the child the objects and say, can you make it light up? Now, again, you might ask, well, is that really causal or is it just a matter of, more complicated kind of imitation? And Andy had the nice idea that a way of trying to control for that would be by changing the temporal sequence of the events. So in the causal demonstration that I just showed you, what happened was that the experimenter poked the platform and then the egg lit up. In the control case, exactly the same series of events happened, so the children saw exactly the same actions, but now the effect actually happened before the experimenter produced the intervention. So now what happened was that instead of it being that the experimenter poked it and then 2 seconds later the egg went on, the egg went on, and then 2 seconds later, the experimenter poked the panel. And then we gave children a score from +2 to -2, depending on how many times they did the act. And we also looked at whether they predictively looked towards the effect when they acted. So what happened was when the children actually poked the block, the egg actually didn't light up, and then the question was, would the children turn around to actually look at the place where the egg was, which would suggest that they were also trying to actually bring about the event. And in fact, what we discovered with 24-month-olds was that the 24-month-olds would produce the response in the causal case, but they didn't in the control case. So in the control case, where the temporal information indicated that the action was not actually bringing about the event, the children were equally likely to choose either one of the actions. Whereas in the causal condition, the children consistently were choosing the correct action. So that takes the finding that Liz and Laura had gotten and I think makes it stronger in saying that what the children are doing is actually genuinely intervening in order to bring about the event based on the correlation, the outcome of the correlation that you see the other person doing. Now, the next question we can ask is there something special about seeing the human intervention? What happens if you see exactly the same pattern of correlations again, but without the human intervention? So in this case, you see almost exactly the same setup, but now instead of poking the platform, what you're doing is actually moving a disc towards that center thing. And you move one disc and the egg lights up, move the other disc and the egg light doesn't light up, and then the question is which thing will the child actually choose? And the two conditions are exactly the same except that in one case it's actually a human agent who's making contact, and in the other case, the disc simply slides along the top of the table and makes contact. And the results of this look very much like the results from Liz and Laura's experiment. In the human cause, the children are very good at picking the right outcome, just as we might expect from the previous one. But when they simply see the correlation without actually seeing any human agency or intervention, then, although in this case they did a bit better than they did in Liz and Laura's, where the children never accomplished the task, they're still much, much worse at doing it, much less likely to do it, the 24-month-olds are, than in the case where they are actually witnessing an agent bring about the event. Okay, so what all this suggests is that there's an interesting developmental change between 24 months and 48 months. By the way, when we did this experiment, I'll get to this in a minute, with preschoolers were fine at the natural case. So what that suggests is that there may be this developmental transition from an early notion of causation, which is very, very directly tied to perceived human agency, to a later notion of causation, which is more abstract, which integrates ideas about objects just interacting out there in the world and objects changing as a result of human agency. Another question that we could ask is, what's the situation for non-human animals? So do non-human animals look more like the toddlers or more like the preschoolers or not really much like either? Now, we know that non-human animals are capable of both classical and instrumental conditioning, which means that they're capable of picking up correlations in an associationist way. We know that they have something like Jim's egotistic notion of causation because they're capable of operant conditioning. Interestingly, in all the years and years and years of studies of behavior studies of animal learning, no one's actually ever shown that non-human animals can combine those two. And that's the point about the title, about why don't Pavlov's dogs ring the bell? Why is it that when animals see a correlation, like Pavlov's dogs seeing the correlation between the bell and the food, they seem to predict that the food will appear, but they don't actually intervene to bring about the consequence of the food appearing? Now, there's a very interesting result which is relevant to this, but actually in some ways makes the whole thing more puzzling, so I'll just tell you about the result. There is evidence that rats seem to treat their own interventions differently from just predictions and observations. So they seem to recognize the difference between their own interventions and other variables. And this is a very clever experiment that was actually in Science by Aaron Blaisdell. And what he did was set up a situation in which the rats either saw this kind of common cause structure or a causal chain structure. And this was established initially with temporal information. So what happened was that the rats saw a light that was followed by a tone independently, and then they saw that the light was followed by food, or they saw a light that was followed, they saw the light followed by the tone followed by food. Okay. And then what happened was that the rats had a chance to actually intervene by pressing a lever, and the lever caused the tone to take place. Now, what happened in this circumstance is that the rats pressed the lever equally in both circumstances, which would seem to indicate that they hadn't really appreciated the causal structure. So the causal story is that in the first case, in the common cause case, there's a correlation between the tone and the food, but the tone is not actually causing the food. So if you want to get the food, you shouldn't actually be trying to bring about the tone. In the second case, there's actually a causal relationship between the tone and the food. So you should bring about the tone if you want to bring about the food. Has everybody sort of got that? So the curious thing is that the rats respond equally in both those circumstances, but they're more likely to anticipate the food in the second case than in the first case. So if you look at their nose pokes, which means when they actually go to the container that has the food in it, they're more likely to anticipate the food and go to the food in the second case where there's the chain than in the first case. So they're making different predictions based on something about knowing whether something is the effect of their own intervention or not. But they don't seem to be translating that into actually making a more effective intervention, which just seems peculiar, and I don't have an explanation for this. This is just what the finding is. So, it's striking that they're capable of making some of these discriminations, but it's also striking that they're not using the correlation as a basis for their own interventions. Okay. So we decided that we wanted to test this in a population that we knew something that was easy to deal with and intelligent and raised in a rich ecological circumstance, as close as we could get to our preschoolers. So we looked at the domestic dog, not to mention the fact that they're actually the ones that Pavlov talked about. And this is work in collaboration with Lucy Jacobs, who has actually a dognition lab at Berkeley, where she studies cognition in domestic dogs. So we adopted the techniques that we'd used for children to try and make sure that we could have a technique that would be exactly the same for children and for dogs. And here's what we came up with after having collaborated with a graduate student who was actually a dog trainer. The way that this works is that that object in the middle, I'm sorry you can't see this very well, is what's called a treat and train. It's actually a machine that dispenses dog treats and that dog trainers use. And on either side of it, there's one of our Blicket detectors that we use for studying causal inference. This is a machine that lights up and plays music. So the treat and train is in the middle, and there's two of these machines that light up and play music on either side. And then on top of these two machines, there are these target sticks, they're called. And what happens is that there's three phases in the design. In the observation, in the observation phase, what happens is that the dog simply sees that there's a correlation between one of the machines lighting up and not the other. So there's no sticks now. What happens is the machine on the left lights up, the treat and train dispenses treats, the machine on the right lights up, the treat and train doesn't do anything. So this is like the two-choice paradigm that we had with the kids. Okay. And we wait until the dogs are anticipating the treats when they see the right-hand one light up, which the dogs very rapidly learn this, and they start anticipating it. Then in the next phase, the demonstration phase, what happens is that we take away the treat and train, so the treat and train isn't there anymore, and we actually operantly teach the dogs to make the light appear. So the dogs actually get a chance to intervene by pressing, by knocking over that target stick, that the light will appear after they light over the targets, they knock over the target stick. And they learn that for both boxes. And we make sure that they have equal trials and that they've shown that they understand this equally well for both boxes before we proceed. So the animals actually get a chance to figure out how to bring about the event. And then in the test, what happens is just that the two boxes with the target sticks are introduced and the treat and train is in the middle. And then the question is, which box will the dog actually go to? So will the dog go to the effective box or the non-effective box based on the correlational information that they have? And essentially what happens is the dogs are a chance. So the dogs aren't choosing the correct intervention. In spite of the fact that they clearly had done the classical conditioning part, they understood the correlation, they understood the contingency, and they knew how to bring about the effect, they didn't seem to put those two things together. And we did various kinds of things to try and help. So in one case, we actually did the training first, in case they might have gotten distracted or forgotten. So we got them, trained them on the sticks first, and then gave them the correlational information. That didn't help. We also tried increasing their motivation. We weren't going to starve these dogs, so instead we chose ball crazy dogs, and the treat and train actually dispensed balls, which these dogs will do any, ball crazy dogs, again, this is my graduate student dog trainer telling me this, will do anything to get a ball. But increasing motivation actually sort of made it worse because they were so crazy about the balls that they didn't want to pay attention to the problem. Interestingly, however, and I don't have a slide for this because we've only just finished this up, as a control condition, we thought, well, think about Jim's picture about those three stages. If the dogs are egocentric, do have an egocentric causal theory, then if they bring about the event, then they ought to be able to learn from it. So in this control condition, what we did was exactly the same thing. So it was exactly the same sequence of events, except now in the observation case, the sticks were there and the dogs learned that when they knocked off the stick themselves, then they actually brought about the event. Otherwise, the whole structure of the experiment was exactly the same. And it turns out that if we do that, then the dogs always get it right. So if the dogs have even just had one or two trials of knocking the thing off themselves, then they immediately choose the right one, which also suggests that it isn't that they've forgotten the information in the last phase, and it isn't that they aren't motivated to actually bring about the result. So if in the first phase they actually see this correlation as an outcome of their own actions, then in the last phase they make the right choice. Then we wanted to see whether, in fact, what would happen if we did this with children. So what we did was exactly, as you can see, we're quite proud of this, we actually have exactly the same setup with the children. It's the same Likert detectors and the same treat and train. Instead of target sticks, we gave them cones that they had to take off the machine, but otherwise the actions are exactly the same. And the treat and train dispenses marbles instead of dispensing dog food. We even had the same, in both conditions, by the way, we had no causal language. In fact, we didn't use any language at all. All we did was just do the demonstration without saying anything about what was going on so that the children and the dogs would be comparable on that level as well. And I think this is also nice because it gives us a kind of convergent test of whether the children can use the correlations. Notice that in this case, unlike Andy's, the Meltzoff case or the Liz and Laura case, there's no movement involved. There's just the kind of pure correlation between the event, the causes and the effects. And we contrasted this for the, something I should have said and didn't, was one of the things that we did, well, let me show you this and then I'll mention it. We contrasted this with an imitation condition. And in the imitation condition, again, it was exactly the same, except that in the very first demonstration, the children saw a person perform the action and have the outcome take place. And then we tested to see whether they would produce that imitation. So this is like the experiments that Andy had done with seeing the person actually bring about the event, and then choosing between the two events on that basis. And what we discovered was that very much as one might expect from the first two experiments, the toddlers in the imitation condition, the 24-month-olds, were extremely good at solving this task. So if they actually saw the person perform one action that led to one outcome, another action that didn't, then they would actually produce the same action themselves. But in the case where there was simply the correlation without any interventions, the 24-month-olds were a chance. So the 24-month-olds were not choosing one intervention versus the other, even though they had appreciated the correlation. And in fact, the toddlers looked a lot like the dogs did. So both the toddlers and the dogs in this same experiment were at chance on the final version. In contrast, as you might expect from the previous two experiments, when we did the same thing with 3-year-olds and 4-year-olds, by the time children were 4, they seemed to have put together the intervention information and the agency information. So by the time the children were 4, just based on the correlation, they were actually acting to bring about the result themselves. One last thing to say about this is we actually did the imitation version as well with the dogs, and consistent with lots of other evidence that dogs are at best, non-human animals in general, are at best have difficulty with imitation, this didn't help any with the dogs. So the dogs didn't show any improvement when they saw the person actually, when they saw another person or even another dog in one of the experiments that we did bring about the events. It was only when they did it themselves that they seemed to be able to, and motivated to bring about the events. So fours did choose the effective intervention with natural observation. Oops, sorry. I'll go over again. Okay, so what are some of the conclusions from this? I think what this suggests is that it's at least conceivable that outcomes of goal-directed actions are very, very centrally connected to our notions about causation from the time that we're very young. And it may be that the more abstract notion of intervention, the more abstract notion of causation, which includes both the outcomes, the downstream outcomes of our goal-directed actions, and just relationships among objects in the world independently of our actions on them, is actually a later development. And another point is that it may be that there's a kind of process of integration going on, such that some of these different conceptions of causality that have been worried over and fought over in the philosophical literature and about which we seem to have different intuitions might start out being fairly separate from one another and then actually be integrated into a single notion of causation, one that includes ideas about correlations among events in the world, outcomes of intentional actions, and various kinds of physical contact and folk physics, that may actually be a developmental process. And it's conceivable that actually the fact that our causal language describes all of those things in the same way, so we say both, can you make it go, to describe the action intervention case, and it makes it go in the case where there's simply objects that are interacting out there in the world, it may be that some of those linguistic facts are part of why we as adults think that we have an integrated notion of causation that seems to include this kind of dog's breakfast of all these different notions and ideas. So the developmental work, again, both from an evolutionary perspective and from a developmental ontogenetic perspective, I think gives us some interesting insights about what our everyday conceptions of causation actually are all about, how they might be related to each other, how some of them might actually be derived from others. And there's a kind of interesting suggestion that from an evolutionary perspective, an interesting way station in our understanding of causation is our ability to map our own actions and our own intentions onto the actions and intentions of other people. And again, if you think of it from an evolutionary perspective, our ability to do things like learn by observation from experts seems to be one of the things that's very characteristic of human beings and seems to be one of the things that makes us particularly effective learners and actors in the world. And the suggestion here is that that may be, in some ways, at the core of some of our ideas about causation. So I'll stop there. I'm assuming I'm done.
Thank you, Alison.
Thank
you, Alison.
The three stages that you had, the woman mm-hmm. had up there, the last stage, if I get it right, was the fully causal viewpoint was this idea of kind of an abstract view of causation where stuff can happen out in the world without.
Right.
But I wondered whether there wasn't, I don't know, the four stages isn't right, but often one of the interesting things I've always found interesting is that this kind of abstract view of causation, we often imply an agent. So, you know, there's some gods or some spirits or some,
right.
you know, something like that going on there. I wondered how that fitted into this picture, where the abstract view of causation implies some sort of unseen agency or something like that.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting question. And obviously, even the third stage isn't the sort of full Woodward abstract exogenous cause notion. So I think it's arguable that some of the fallacies that we have as adults, things like placebo effects, for example, and other kinds of mistakes that were superstitions, other kinds of mistakes that we make come because we haven't yet pulled out the notion of causation as just sort of a set of, as it were, structural equation relationships out there in the world from the notion of causation as the outcome of somebody's intentional directed agency. So I think one of the things that you might predict from this is that you'd find cases of even adults getting confused or getting things wrong in cases that involve agency. But you know, I'm not quite sure whether it's really getting things wrong, because this might also be relevant to the sort of thing that Peter was talking about, where, I mean, you could make the argument that, after all, what the structural equations are picking out, right, the reason why we care about those relations in the world, and there's a metaphysical question about whether those relations in the world would be a natural kind independently of the fact that they're susceptible to certain kinds of intervention, then from that perspective, then maybe thinking about causation in terms of intervention isn't a mistake. So in terms of, you know, Peter's level two, there's an interesting question about is what's there that we're picking out in the world something that's independent of our interventions and agency, or is it that the very reason why we pick that out in the world is because we think that in some sense you can cash it out in terms of interventions in the world? But I think it would actually be interesting to find out whether that's true. I mean, one of the questions that in the developmental work is, for instance, when those children are seeing the invisible object move towards the other object without any agent, do they sort of think that there might be some hidden agency? So do they sort of act as if the fact that the block is moving is making it into a kind of animate, itself making it into a kind of animate agent, in the case where they actually succeed in that case?
I've got a question which is sort of related to that. I'm wondering whether you could elaborate this kind of picture a bit. Let me start just somewhere else. So if you just kind of stopped at the first stage, the ego's entrance stage, you might think that even at that stage, there's a kind of progression that an agent who's sort of not aware that there are other agents, there's still a kind of progression in thinking which would consist in something like the extension of the kinds of things which were regarded as possible targets of intervention.
Right.
So you might imagine that a child or a simple kind of creature would have a very limited range of views as to where agency might take place, but then might kind of extend and might, you know, even in principle extend to the things, to sort of imagining acts where what was moved was something like the moon.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be a way of getting to something which would, in one sense, look very much like the third stage here, in the sense that it would involve relations between, it would involve things like motions of the moon as causes, but which wouldn't have got there by going through this process, but would have got there by a different kind of generalization, a generalization just at the first level on the class of possible actions from that ecocentric point of view.
Well, to go back to the original Piagetian idea, for instance, I think one of the interesting things about the studies in the two choice case is that Piaget, for instance, said, well, the relationship between my decision to move my hand and my hand moving, I might think of that as being the kind of causal relationship. And I think there's quite a lot of evidence that even very young infants make some predictions about goal-directed actions and the fact that goal-directed actions will have an influence on the object on which they're directed, right? So even very young infants, this is work that Rebecca Sachs has done, even very young infants seem to think that an object, a hand making contact with an object, is more likely to lead to a change in the object than, say, simply an object that makes contact with the other object. So they already seem to have a sort of idea that there's this special thing, which is the relationship between your actions, your goal-directed actions, and the states of objects in the world. But of course, the thing that Jim talks about in the interventionist theory is not that relationship, but rather the relationship between downstream, between the fact that I fix this variable, and then there's a downstream effect later on. So on Jim's account, that's really where the causal relationship takes place. I mean, not that this first part isn't causal, but that the way that you define causality is in terms of that downstream relationship. And you could ask how downstream, as it were, I think this is just saying the same thing that you're saying.
I think what I was suggesting was that there were kind of two ways of generalizing, which are involved in getting to something, at least to the third stage, if not to Jim's final position, which probably reinforce one another. One is becoming this egocentric in this sort of sense, especially going from step one to step two, and thereby seeing the actions of other people as examples that one can use.
Right.
For example, in thinking about, seeing other people acting might well act as something which would help generalization in the sense I was suggesting, where you generalize the sense of your own possible actions. So I think, although I was suggesting making the picture a little bit more complicated, I think it looks to me as if it'll be in a sort of mutually reinforcing.
I think that's right. There are going to be other kinds of dimensions of change that are going on as well as this one. One thing that I should mention is we did 24-month-olds, but it seems very plausible that much younger, my guess is that the kids are not ever going to be in that stage one, purely egocentric stage. That as soon as, I think we have a lot of independent reasons to think this, that as soon as they can actually, say, produce a goal-directed action themselves, there is good evidence for this, and in fact, as soon as they can produce a goal-directed action themselves, they interpret the actions of another person that are similar as if they are similarly goal-directed. So I think we have good reason to believe that the kids are always making the mapping onto the actions of other people, rather than which apparently the dogs are not doing, and certainly having much more difficulty in doing.
Yes.
experiment, I can't remember who did this one now, where they would reverse the sequence of the
right,
life and
right.
The switch. It just unsettled me that seemed so. I was wondering, is there surely some other ideas you tried out, or that experiment could have tried out to discern, is it really causal? It seemed that's such a departure from the original condition. It seems kind of too easy to get a result there, and it might be something more subtle that you could do.
Yeah, I mean, the advantage of the reason why we wanted to have that control is because, again, so this is the work with Andy, and Andy Maltsov, as you may know, is the great king of imitation. He was the first person to actually show that newborns and then later infants were imitating in various kinds of ways. So the question that we were really worried about in that whole series of experiments is this really just a matter of imitation? So is it just a matter of the children deciding? For example, it could be that even when we have the two-choice situation, after all, the light is going on in one case and not in the other, and you might think, well, the light just is making that case more salient for the children. So something happens, the light goes on, and that just leads the children to pay more attention to that action than the other action. So, you know, these are explanations that are boring from a deep philosophical perspective, but these are exactly the explanations that you have to worry about, possibilities you have to worry about when you're doing the developmental work. And the temporal one was one that we liked because almost all the other dimensions like that are actually going to be controlled for. But there might be more subtle ways of making it be non-causal, like maybe having it be, you know, the result of a common cause versus being a chain. And in fact, we're now doing the Blaisdell common cause versus chain experiment with 24-month-olds to try and see what happens. So there are more subtle ways that you can do it. But this was a way of taking care of the sort of obvious objections, which are so boring that they probably wouldn't occur to a philosopher, but are exactly the things that we have to worry about as developmentalists.
Helen, then.
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure this question makes sense. Do you have a view about the relationship between the kind of association that's generating the expectation mm-hmm. and the kind of the intervention thing that seems to be generating the kind of the causal belief? Mm-hmm. I mean, so you answered part of that question already, which is you can, in the two-year-olds, you're getting the expectation without the causal judgment, right? I just wondered if you had anything else to say about, like, I know, do you need the association in order to get the causal judgment
right.
always, or could you somehow get the causal judgment in the absence of the association?
Well, there is some evidence that in these, like, these Machadian mechanism cases, those are cases where you seem to see the kids making the judgment without seeing any kind of correlational outcome. Although it's hard to tell because, of course, by the time you've got a 7-month-old, they actually have seen lots and lots of cases of launching and contact and so forth. So there's a debate about whether that's really separate from the associations or not. One thing that I think is interesting is, as you may know, there's a long debate in the developmental literature about the fact that very often what happens is if you test infants on a prediction task, like these looking time tasks, you get one result, whereas if you test infants on a task that actually involves their action, you get a different result. And one interesting thought is, part of the reason why we did the two-choice case was, in a very simple way, that requires a kind of counterfactual reasoning. Not a kind of past counterfactual reasoning, but a kind of future interventionist kind of counterfactual reasoning, because now what the children in effect have to do is say, all right, if I intervene on this block, what will happen is one thing, and if I intervene on the other block, then what will happen is something else, and now I'm going to make my decision based on that forward inference. That's what discriminates it from just the simple imitation case. And I think it's actually a very interesting case, given that we have so much nice formal and philosophical work that suggests that prediction and both intervention and counterfactual reasoning might be really different, that you could do one without doing the other, that the mechanisms for them are so different. I think it's quite not implausible that very often infants are detecting correlations and using them to make, infants and non-human animals are detecting correlations and using them to make predictions without having the framework to be able to do these counterfactuals these kind of counterfactual interventions at all. And then it becomes a very interesting question. We're looking at 24-month-olds here, and they're already pretty sophisticated by developmental standards. We don't know what would happen if we tried to do this with, say, 6-month-olds or 7-month-olds. They might very well not be able to produce these kind of goal-directed actions at all, even in the imitation case. I'm not sure whether that's true or not. But it does suggest that the kind of apparatus for doing prediction and correlation, the kind of thing that underpins, say, associationist theories, might well be in place and be enabling prediction and just be completely fail to be integrated with something that actually enables you to go out and do kind of counterfactual based interventions. And that might not be coming online until later. An interesting thought that I just had in the last couple of days is, it's kind of interesting that that age, 24 months, is also the age when we start seeing pretend play. And one of the great mysteries of developmental psychology is, why is it that at about 18 months you suddenly see this enormous explosion of pretend play? Why is it that, you know, kids are doing this 24/7, and children across cultures in lots of different circumstances? And one thought might be that pretend play is a way of kind of exercising this counterfactual generating ability. And it might be that there's a developmental story where early on you're detecting the correlations, but not doing this kind of more elaborate counterfactual causal reasoning, which I think would be an interesting, developmental possibility.
Actually, I'm not sure if my question was, you talk about children imitating, mm-hmm. and whether dogs imitate.
Right.
You did, I think, say that the dogs didn't learn by observation, by watching other dogs.
It's a vexed question. They certainly don't do it as easily or with as much facility as the as even literally newborn human infants do. So by the time infants are, from the time infants are born, they're imitating facial expressions, and by the time they're 9 months old, they're imitating actions on objects. So if you take a 9-month-old and you bang your head on top of a block and it lights up, then the 9-month-old, never having done this before, will do the same thing. We certainly don't see anything like that in non-human animals. There's a debate about whether non-human animals might be learning by what's sometimes called emulation, so that there do seem to be some cases where, you know, the example are the monkeys using termites, using sticks to get termites, where it does seem that by watching what someone else is doing, the animals are getting information which they then use themselves. But the kind of imitation that we see in even 9-month-olds of, you know, immediately getting, just for the sake of doing this, I'm going to do the same thing that the other person is doing, at least is much more difficult to see in dogs and non-human animals in general. And, you know, it's one of those things where if you do, you train them really heavily and it's something that's already in their repertoire, then there's some evidence that they might be able to do it. But they're certainly not doing it as spontaneously or as naturally as the children are doing.
I was thinking of the monkeys in Japan that started to learn to salt their
right.
potatoes or the monkeys put them in salt water.
Yeah, again, the trouble is that if you don't know the history exactly, one possibility is that it could be that they were imitating, but it could also be that what happened is that they are, say, the potatoes and the water become salient to them because they're watching other animals doing things with the potatoes and the water, and then they, just as a matter of just sort of in their natural repertoire, start doing things that are closer to the water because that's where the other monkeys are, closer to the water, and then they discover through operant conditioning that, or not through operant conditioning, through this kind of egotistical causal process, then they dip something in the water and then discover that it's actually good. And there's a lot of debate in the literature about whether which one of those two is actually the right description of what's going on in those cases. And you can't tell from just the anecdotes.
John, yeah, just follow up on some things you said in response to Helen's question. So as you pointed out, so counterfactual thought and causal thought are in your view kind of distinct. I wonder if you think there's any it seems like in light of some things that came up in your Menzies talk, there are right. some connections between them. I'm wondering if you think that, as it were, one's the outgrowth of the other, so you might,
right.
on your sort of view, the counterfactual thing would be an outgrowth of the causal thing, or if you think they're just kind of separate systems running in tandem, or if they're similar.
Right. No, I don't think they're separate systems running in tandem. I think they're actually closely related. My My take would be that the, let's see if I can articulate this, from a psychological perspective, I think the part that is, analytic probably isn't the right word, but the part that's sort of deeply involved in the concept of causation is intervention and the kind of counterfactual reasoning that's involved in intervention. I think you'd have good evolutionary reasons for thinking that. Now, it's an interesting developmental question, and I don't know the answer to it. When kids are about 18 months old, you start seeing things that look like counterfactual interventions in the sense that you start seeing things like insightful planning, where you simply look at the problem and work out what the solution is without actually having to do any kind of trial and error. And that suggests something like a kind of capacity for counterfactual intervention. You see that at about 18 months. But on the other hand, by the time kids are two and a half or three, they're doing good old-fashioned, you know, Lewisian counterfactuals. So they'll say things like, you know, the room is muddy, and Ducky came into the room with his muddy boots, and if Ducky's muddy boots hadn't been muddy, would there be mud on the floor? But Paul Harris has done this. And especially if you do this about things like little children making a terrible mess, then they do perfectly fine at making counterfactual inferences. And you have to be sort of clever because the language is complicated, but I think you can show that even little ones, when they understand the causal structure, will make counterfactuals. So my guess would be that the interventions are primary and then the kind of classical backwards counterfactuals are secondary, but I don't know that we actually have good empirical evidence for it. It could be the fact that pretend is showing up so early, and pretend, after all, is these completely fictional counterfactuals, not interventions. It might be that what happens is that as soon as you get the capacity to do any kind of counterfactual, that from an evolutionary point of view, as it were, the reason for you to have that, the purpose is to do the interventions, but that conceptually what happens is you just get the capacity to do the counterfactuals, and then you just do them you can do any kind of non-actual reasoning that you want. That would
The latter for point of view, I guess the counterfactuals aren't selected for, the Lewisian stuff isn't selected for, it's just kind of a span.
Exactly, that's right. Yeah, that is my view. So my view would be that the interventions are the ones that are selected for, and then my slogan for this is that counterfactuals are the terrible price that we pay for future hypotheticals. So our capacity for most of what counterfactuals do is cause us regret and guilt, but that's actually the flip side of our being able to have hope and planning. So it's hope and pride are the flip side of the guilt and regret of counterfactuals. Guilt and regret are the spandrels that come along with hope and pride.
Lloyd.
This is raising to me, which I call it the pathology of causal thinking. I mean, does any of the empirical research, I don't think any of the philosophy can contribute to this, but one of the things that's so bewildering about human beings is, you know, superstition.
Yeah.
And also, you know, human sacrifice to make sure the sun rises. Mm-hmm. I mean, how on earth does this, you know, the deep feature of us about causal thinking, mm-hmm. how does it go so awry? Are we going to have to go to sort of neurophysiology and find out that some kind of deep wiring is going wrong? I mean, how could these ghastly errors have arisen out of the developmental process you're talking about?
Well, I think, in fact, thinking about the developmental process as being very, very deeply rooted in goal-directed actions and interventions actually gives us a way of thinking about a lot of the mistakes that we make about causal reasoning. Because if you think about the example of superstition, for example, the kind of classic example is, you know, I get in the car and turn the keys and an alarm somewhere else goes off and I'm convinced that it was actually the causal outcome of what I did. And I think it might very well be that when children are so good at being tuned into the causal outcomes of what other people do and of what they do themselves, that even when what happens is not the result of an ideal intervention, which is what when you ought to make the causal inference, that you're going to make the causal inference anyway. And I think a lot of the mistakes that we make causally, you can see as being the sort of gap between this intervention in the literal sense view of causation and the kind of abstract normative sense that you'd need for something like Jim's theory. But I think another dimension, which I was mentioning when we were talking about chance, is some of the differences between psychological causation and physical causation. So a thought that I've had recently is that, you know, one of the things that seems like it's a terrible counter evidence to this view that we're such good causal learners is the entire history of medicine, right? So the entire history of medicine would seem to be like this giant counter demonstration to the idea that we're good at doing causal inference, given that for 2,000 years we, well, more than 2,000 years probably, we accepted all sorts of medical advice for which we had absolutely no causal evidence at all. So why is it that you would, why is it that, you know, you'd have this and a mistake that literally cost us lives, right? Why would we have this disastrous mistake? Well, one thought is that I think we have some evidence to think that children are originally discriminating between the kind of physical causation that's going on in this case and psychological causation, and that they treat those as to some extent having very different principles and operating and working in very different kinds of ways. If you think the placebo effects are real, which they are, then it might be very unlikely to have a hypothesis that there's a placebo effect, because the placebo effect would involve what looked like a crossing domain boundaries that shouldn't be there, right? But since placebo effects are real, if you're going out and seeing what the other people do and what the outcomes of them are, what you're going to see is, oh yeah, when this person does this intervention, the person who they perform the intervention on is more likely to get better than when you don't perform the intervention. That would be a completely accurate reading of the evidence, because placebo effects actually are real. So, and of course, the more confident the person is that about what it is that they're doing, like, you know, witch doctors of all ages, including the ones who have MDs now, the more likely the placebo effect actually is to turn out to be real. So you could argue that what seems like this wild irrationality about our accepting all of this medical nonsense for all these years is actually a perfectly plausible inference if you think that the downstream outcomes of interventions, especially interventions by people who you trust, are the best indicator of causal relationships. So that would be an example, I think, where what in general is quite a good way of thinking, without the extra bells and whistles that say are in all of those subcategories of Jim's book about causation, could end up leading to something that looked like a kind of pathological inference.
Another pathology is, of course, you were touching on treating the psychological agency, getting it muddled up with physical.
Yeah, that's
right. I would
have
thought, you know, paranoia and the conspiracy thinking, sort of, it's kind of animism involved. You know, and I'm just curious as to.
Yeah, I think there's some very interesting.
Does any help with understanding that kind of pathology? And you've touched on people.
I think very often these issues about what happens in different domains, and particularly what happens in the psychological and what happens in the physical domain, are places where you could end up with things that in some sense were perfectly good outcomes of perfectly good causal inference, but that ended up looking as if they were weird. I mean, the example I give in my book is, you know, why is it that you think that it's witchcraft if you dress up and make gestures and make certain kinds of noises and then you get someone pregnant, whereas you think it's just psychology if you dress up and make noises and make certain gestures and get someone to sleep with you, right? I mean, that second case is perfectly good, straightforward psychological causation. So why would you not think that things like dressing up, making noises, saying things in a particular order would have causal effects? They have causal effects all the time. They have the most powerful causal effects of anything we do. So it seems like it's not crazy to think that they would have effects, especially effects like making someone sick or making someone well or other kinds of psychological effects. I think, by the way, this indeterminism question in the psychological versus the physical case is another interesting case where we might end up with strange views about the world as a result of what start out as being rational ways of trying to track, say, what happens in psychological causation. And we're just starting to do more and more work now on kids' understanding of psychological causation and how do they think that it's related to physical causation and how is it the same and different and so forth.
You know, Robin Martin years ago made this distinction between cultures in which the physical explanatory model has become rejected for phenomena beyond the ordinary human level, and cases where the human thing, he thinks that the 17th century, so to speak, solidified the tendency in Western civilization, Western cultures, to when you're trying to explain things much bigger than human actions and much smaller, do you use the analogy from agency,
right,
or the analogy from mechanisms?
Mm-hmm.
And he says, well, in the West, we got it right. We went for mechanisms. He said, there are cultures in which they go for agency, right? And he says, they're often people who are much more alert to the influences that brothers and sisters are having on each other and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But they're also more prone to what we regard as superstition.
Well, I think one of the things that comes out of this, at least suggested by that, Paul Munter and Bonowitz result about the contact is, and I'm slightly surprised about this, is that it may be that at least by the time that children are 20 are preschoolers and using language, the whole mechanistic story is getting integrated here too, so that the mechanistic force transmission sort of picture of causation and the agent-based picture of causation are getting treated as if they're mutually informative from relatively early on in development, though apparently not from the very beginning of development, because the 24-month-olds are not integrating those. They're not treating those as if they're giving each other relevant information.
Distinguishing the kind of force transmission from counterfactual stuff, so action at a distance. Do kids look for the wires when there's a button and a light? Or are they quite happy to accept that things can sort of happen without any obvious connection?
Right. We actually did that experiment for exactly that reason. So we did this with 4-year-olds, and we did an experiment where we pitted probabilities versus contact. And it was a very simple experiment. The 4-year-olds come in, there's two of our little blicket detectors that light up, and one blicket detector, so we start out by showing that the children start out assuming that there's going to be contact. So we say, how will this work? How can you make this go? And they make contact between the block and the detector. Then we show them two blocks. One block is held up over top of the detector, and it makes it go 2 out of 3 times. The other block makes contact with the detector, and it only makes it go 1 out of 3 times. And then we ask the children which one is the better block, which one makes it go, and then we let them choose which one they want to choose. And 4-year-olds sort of amazingly, quickly, and easily choose the one that has the higher probability, even when it doesn't have contact. And we can even do sort of screening off. We did a sort of screening off version of this experiment where you have one block on the detector, and then you're holding another block up simultaneously, right? And then you show them that independently, the contact block makes it go. So first you show them the contact block doesn't make it go. Holding it up like this independently does make it go. Now you show them a situation in which it's going, and both the one block is making contact and one block is being held up top, and you say, can you make it stop? And the 4-year-olds will move this block, move the block that isn't making contact, rather than moving the block that is making contact. So rather surprisingly, but true, they don't seem to have very strong, if they have mechanism constraints, they certainly aren't strong mechanism constraints. And there's some interesting work by Frank Kyle with adults showing something that he calls the illusion of explanatory depth, which suggests that even though adults sort of think that they should have mechanisms, they usually don't. So if you ask people, do you understand how a helicopter works? Or do you understand how a zipper works? They say, yeah, I understand how it works. Well, do you really understand? I mean, do you know the mechanism? And people say, no, I know the mechanism. And we can try it here, all right? And then you say, all right, so how does a zipper work? And people say, they know the interventions, and they know the counterfactuals. They know that if you pull on the tab, it'll go, but they have no idea about what the mechanism is. So mechanisms are sort of curious, because it is true that we sort of think that we ought to know what the mechanisms are, but actually we seem to get along just fine, I think, with the right sets of interventions and counterfactuals. So it's an interesting, so in some ways that argues against a mechanism theory. In other ways, it argues for a mechanism theory in that, why is it that people feel as if they should lie about it, right? Why is it that people don't just say, well, that's irrelevant. It doesn't matter whether I know what the mechanism is or not.
Toby, did you have another?
I think my last question now, I forgot what it was.
this book.
Okay, are there other questions? I had a sort of semi-frivolous question. I was thinking about the dogs. I mean, do they control for the kind of dogs? I mean,
yeah.
Intuitively, you know, border collies would be much
right.
better at this.
No, I mean, that's actually very serious. So we've talked a lot with the trainers about, you know, which kinds of dogs should we be testing. And it's interesting because we started out testing search and rescue dogs. Not search and rescue dogs. We started out testing clicker trained dogs. So these are dogs who have actually been trained to respond to commands because that makes them better sort of experimental subjects. But it may be that those dogs are actually an interesting general perspective about dogs is that dogs are so socially sensitive that they may not be paying attention to physical causation essentially at all. So one of the next things that we're doing is doing exactly this task, but doing it with a social relationship rather than with a physical relationship, because there are some suggestions in the literature that dogs have become evolved to be so sensitive, especially to human social and psychological signals, that that's the thing that they think is most important. And of course, in fact, one of the things that happens with some of the dogs in our studies is what they do is go to the person and start begging them to do the trick or treat, the thing. That's sort of like the default dog strategy is, come on, you master, take care of this for me. You must know how this works. My line about dogs is that dogs are basically Stepford wolves, right? So they're wolves who've actually been trained over evolution to make us believe that they're these docile creatures who love us and just care about our needs. We actually have done these experiments with wolves. So that's another thing that we're doing is going down to a wolf park on the assumption that maybe the wolves would actually have retained more of their understanding of physical causality as opposed to the dogs who may have lost it in the process of becoming domesticated. Yeah.
Well, I mean, some dogs seem to be trained to do rather elaborate kind of control dogs. I mean, control tasks from sheep
right.
dogs in particular.
Yeah.
And there's also a question as to whether they have to think of the sheep as agents
right.
in order to be able to do as well as they do.
And as I say, we're also testing search and rescue dogs on the principle that search and rescue dogs might be more independent than, say, these domestic dogs who've learned very much to interact with masters. But it's a hard call because in some ways the dogs that seem most intelligent are often the dogs who have become most sensitized to people. So we just have to find out. Anyway, it certainly is one of the things that we think about. There also seems to be more individual variation among the dogs on these tests than there is. Seems to be among the children.
Okay, so no more questions. We're pretty much on time. Let's thank Alison for a fascinating. We start again at 2:15.